Hello and welcome to the second hour of Jazz for the Asking. Keith Parent back with you for another hour of this wonderful music. And we're going to continue with our conversation with Russ Davis, host of Jazz America on the VOA. But to begin this first hour, we're going to take a listen to a track that was recorded in 1969 at the studios of Radio Netherlands in Hilversum, Holland. It's Roy Edgar's big band playing Opus here on Jazz for the Asking.
Thank you.
Roy Edgar's Big Band with Opus, beginning the second hour of Jazz for the Asking. We now continue our conversation with Russ Davis, host of Jazz America on The Voice of America. From your point of view, I mean, if you look back at a lot of the jazz recordings from especially the 50s and 60s, the producer was just as big a star as the artists that were performing. What about today? Does the producer still have, on newer jazz recordings, as an important role as, let's say, Norman Gans, for example, or others?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Keith. You know, some of the famous ones, well, even engineers who also had the function of being a producer, Rudy Van Gelder,
right,
oversaw all those fantastic recordings right across the river from here in Manhattan, over in New Jersey at his awesome studio that so many of the most famous prestige and Blue Note recordings of all time, he oversaw those things. So in essence, he was the producer, though he was really an engineer. Rudy Van Gelder worked with Creed Taylor, who was a producer and the owner of his record label, and they had a specific idea of the kind of things they wanted to do. And quite often they would have a rhythm section and then just bring in the leaders and rehearse the music, and they were in charge, and the leaders just listened to what the engineers and producers were telling them to do. Teo Macero, who did so many of Miles Davis's most famous works. Miles would go in and just play in a free manner, sometimes for over an hour, and then Teo Macero would sit down literally with a razor blade and cut those songs that have become so famous down to 25, 20, 18, 15-minute pieces, and that just doesn't happen anymore. To answer your question specifically, much more today, the artists themselves are being their own producer and director of their entire career. Just as you and I are in charge of 100% of our productions and our programming, that's the way it is for artists these days. And I believe that the producer has a much less important place simply because of the numbers of artists that are taking their own careers by the horn and directing their own careers. It's partly because economics. There aren't the big record labels that are out there that used to be in existence. There are just so few of them because of economics. They had to go out of business. Nobody was buying records and CDs anymore. They were getting their music through downloads, and they just aren't available. For example, there is, on the island of Manhattan, where I live, only one huge record shop you can go to that has a massive jazz section. There is no other record store in New York City where you can go and look over thousands of CDs to buy the music. It just doesn't exist. So no stores and no record companies to speak of, just very few. And the producers used to work for the record labels, and they brought in all the people on their roster and recorded them. Well, that just really doesn't exist anymore. So the answer to your question is producers are certainly not as important as they used to be. It's all on the shoulders of the artist himself or herself.
A few years ago, I watched a documentary on German television about Blue Note Records and about the guys from Germany who went to the United States as immigrants and created Blue Note Records. And the thing about Blue Note that always was, for me, I always thought was very special, wasn't just the recording itself, but also the packaging. And they were interviewing some of the sound technicians and musicians that recorded with the two guys. And they said, you know, both of them were from Germany. They had no rhythm whatsoever. They would be in the studio snapping their fingers and tapping their feet completely out of time to what was being played. But they said they knew exactly what they wanted.
Well, that's the worst kind of client to have. Someone who doesn't know what they want until they hear it. that's so interesting. That says a couple of things. They were businessmen, but they were open to artistic things. And as long as they didn't suppress the real desires of the artists, everything was going to be okay. And obviously they did not. They gave them carte blanche to do what they felt like they wanted to do musically, because they couldn't go in and alter it. They couldn't go in and make suggestions. They just had to sit and enjoy it. So that's a great story.
One of the producers said that one of the funniest moments was Alfred Lion getting on the talkback button, talking to the musicians with a very heavy German accent, telling them what he would like to hear, how he wants the feeling to come across. They just looked at each other and went, okay. the musician that they spoke to said there was something about working with the two of them. They said that, like you just mentioned, they gave them the freedom to do what they want, but they also knew what they wanted to hear themselves, because both of them were jazz fans.
Well, maybe they were trying to express a style they wanted to exhibit on Blue Note, just like the covers were going to be so sophisticated and so creative. They had a certain style in mind that they wanted the music to project, a certain style they wanted to have in Blue Note recordings. I can understand that to a certain extent. I mentioned Creed Taylor before. Creed Taylor was an A&M Records producer and decided he wanted to make jazz more popular. So he was going. He had a very specific idea of the style of recordings that he wanted to have on his label. And there wasn't going to be a broad spectrum of styles. It was going to be in a certain pocket. So he brought in Don Sobeski as his arranger, and he made sure that Wes Montgomery and Hubert Laws and George Benson and Freddie Hubbard, they all had a certain sort of sound and style to those recordings, and it helped keep jazz popular at a time when lots of folks thought it was sort of aimless in style. So I think the Alfred Lions and et cetera, they had a specific idea of what the kind of sound they wanted. And for the most part, in the beginning especially, they had that small group acoustic sound that was going to happen, and it was very, very solid. And then they allowed others to develop, like soul jazz and modal jazz and free jazz, and all those other things evolved, but in the beginning, they had a very specific idea of the kind of sound they wanted. That's probably what he was saying over that that speaker in the studio.
What about Chet Baker? And I bring this up because just 2 weeks ago, I have many vinyl discs. I don't even want to tell you how many I have. And I came across one that I totally forgot that I bought it in 1995. It was a reissue of Chet Baker playing with, of all things, a Herb Alpert-style mariachi band. I love Chet Baker, but it's like this stuff is dreadful. And the description on the album, it's odd because he was living in Europe when it was recorded. All the tracks were laid in Los Angeles. They sent the tracks to Europe, where he laid down his flugelhorn. He wasn't even in the studio with the musicians, and he doesn't really play. He just plays little sections here and there. And I'm thinking, you know, either he did this because he was using a lot of drugs at the time, that, or he needed the money.
Oh my goodness! Well, as my wife and I have told our daughter since she was old enough to understand what we were saying, everybody makes mistakes. So I think probably your instincts are probably correct, Keith. He was under the influence of a lot of very strong. He was an addicted person, and it's one of the sad things in jazz history. I've spoken to folks like Roy Haynes, the great drummer, who was there as a young guy in the heyday of bebop, and he played with Charlie Parker, and he played with Miles Davis, and he played with those other guys and Chet Baker, who were all under the influence of not only alcohol but heroin. And some of them never lived to be as old as they should have been because of that. It's pretty obvious, some of them. And he wouldn't even talk about it very much. He said it was just a scourge. So I'm afraid that Chet Baker was certainly, he had such a wonderful natural style. His musical spirit was so strong, but the rest of him was so weak. And he couldn't fight that addiction, and it's a tragedy.
He was also a great vocalist.
Oh, without a doubt. without a doubt. And it really came from his soul and his spirit, his unique style too. The fact that he had that Oklahoma drawl and that sort of Southern sensibility, but at the same time that West Coast sophistication and you know, people just loved his sound. It was so accessible and easy to listen to and take in, and still at the same time adventurous. I mean, you know, he was part of the cool jazz revolution, and just a wonderful style of jazz that came from the West Coast. He and Jerry Mulligan together were just fantastic. And Chico Hamilton was a great drummer that worked with them. And I've known some other people that worked with him too, John Scofield and Dave Samuels and other modern musicians. And they said, those guys were just a wreck. They made great music, but they were so addicted, it was difficult to be around them.
Thank you.
The Chet Baker Sextet with Blues in the Closet. You're listening to Jazz for the Asking. If you wish to get in touch with us, our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. Or you can also contact us via our website and download past editions of the show at www.pcjmedia.com. Our special guest on today's program is Russ Davis, host of Jazz America on the VOA. We now continue with our conversation.
Now, Jazz America airs around the world. Do you find a difference in the response that you get, let's say, from listeners overseas to a show that, let's say, you would do in the United States?
Well, yeah, I suppose so. I do believe there is a constant that runs, a thread that runs through all jazz fans. They resonate to that element in it that I've mentioned before, the freedom of the music. Some people just need their music very structured and in a certain specific style, and they're rigid in the way they want their music to be, no matter what the style may be. And I find that jazz fans all over the world, be they Americans or international, resonate to the freedom in the music and are much more open. But I will say that the international audience is more completely open, I think, than American audiences are, and more open to improvised and even freer styles of music. They can hear and take in more easily a more experimental or avant-garde style of jazz than Americans can. Americans seem to, and this is a generalization, please don't take it as an absolute, in a general sense, Americans are so used to a simpler arrangement, if you will, and more of a blues-based style of jazz and more structured form of jazz, than the international audience, which loves the groove and the simple, funky blues and swing of traditional jazz, but they also like it avant-garde. So if I were going to separate the two, I would say that the international audience is more open to a freer style of jazz. And I think that can be proven to a certain extent by the number of American artists who make their living touring Asia and Europe as opposed to the United States, which is really more of a pop and rock audience, and the numbers of jazz fans is lower than the pop and rock fans, whereas internationally it's more, I'll put under the huge umbrella of simply music fans. I think that the international audience, from what I can tell, could listen to a classical music concert in a traditional way, or a jazz concert, or a hip-hop concert, or a techno concert, and be just as happy. They wouldn't even differentiate. It's just music, whereas Americans may be a little bit more, prejudiced with the kind of music they personally like, and they don't want to expand their horizons as much as the international audience does.
Do you think also part of that could be that in many of these countries, if we take, let's say, Eastern Europe, where, you know, during the Cold War, jazz was illegal and banned in many Eastern European countries and in other parts of the world, do you think that may have a part in it?
Yes, I think so. Obviously, with Willis Conover, that was the main thrust of his presentation, and that was the audience that he reached more directly than any other audience in the world. The Eastern European audience was hungry for the freedom of jazz, and he really served it up to them. Now, with Eastern Europe, it's developed. They have their own jazz radio stations everywhere. It's not that foreign thing that is almost unattainable. Now it's easily attainable, and instead, VOA's Jazz America, which I present, not only goes by shortwave and internet, but also we present it to and offer it to radio stations all around the world to accept. If they have a satellite dish, they can take in the feed and rebroadcast it anytime they like. And that is what happens with a lot of Eastern European radio stations in countries not only there but around the world. Now, those that listen on shortwave, the ones that don't have that infrastructure that more developed countries in Europe and other parts of the world have, they still listen. That audience is responding to me, I think, like the Eastern European audience used to respond to Willis. For example, a large portion of my email communication comes from Africa. African countries don't have the infrastructure quite often that other countries do, and so they're still picking it up on shortwave, and those are the folks that are my Eastern Europe, if you will. So it's an interesting thing that's happened down through the years.
Russ Davis from Jazz America, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Keith, it's been my great, great pleasure. And the only problem I've had here is that your voice is so infinitely more resonant and perfect than mine. I'm jealous. So you have a great presentation, I can tell. And thanks for having me on your program. It really was a joy.
Take five, the Dave Brubeck Quartet, from the album Time Out. Before that, I was speaking with Russ Davis, host of Jazz America on The Voice of America. To find out times and frequencies for your region, just do a search for the VOA website and Jazz America, and you'll have everything listed at your fingertips. You can also download the most recent shows on the Jazz America page on the VOA. And I also invite you to check out Russ Davis's own website, which is russdavismoja.com. I'll spell that for you. That's R-U-S-S, Davis, D-A-V-I-S, Moja, M-O-J-A.com. Don't worry, however, there will be a link to his own website, as well as the VOA's, on our website, pcjmedia.com. We're now going to take a listen to a vocalist. Now, I know as soon as I mention her name, many of you will think that, I think Keith has been having a few drinks during today's show. No, I'm not. Her name is Bjork. Yes, you heard me correctly, Bjork. A number of years ago, she recorded a jazz album with a trio from Iceland. Here she is with I Can't Help Lovin' That Man of Mine, here on Jazz for the Asking.
Fish gotta swim, birds gotta fly. I gotta love one man till I die. Can't help loving that man of mine. Maybe he's lazy, maybe he's slow. Maybe I'm crazy, maybe I know. Can't help loving that man of mine. So swim, bats gotta fly. I gotta love a woman till I die. Jen Hale, loving a man of mine. Hey, maybe it's crazy, maybe it's slow. Maybe I'm crazy, maybe I know. Jen Hale, loving that man of mine. When he's away, that's a rainy day. But when he's found, the day is fine, the sun will shine. He can stay out as long as can be. Home without him ain't no home for me. Jen Hale, loving the thought of mine. Oh,
I Can't Help Lovin' That Man of Mine by Icelandic singer Björk. Yes, you heard me correct, and I will say it again, Björk. With that, we've come to the end of this edition of Jazz for the Asking. Once again, if you wish to contact us, our email address is pcjmedia@gmail.com. That's pcjmedia@gmail.com. You're also invited to check out our website and download all past editions of the show at www.pcjmedia.com. To close off this edition of Jazz for the Asking, we're going to play a track for a listener of ours in Australia. His name is Michael Harding, and he lives in the Australian city of Brisbane. On the last edition of Jazz for the Asking, we played the Dutch Swing College Band. He would like to hear something more recent by them, in particular, a live recording. Well, Michael, here it is for you now, closing off this edition of Jazz for the Asking. The Dutch Swing College Band with China Boy, recorded for ZDF Television in Germany. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you'll join us again very soon for another edition of Jazz for the Asking.